with the 25th annual Evergreen Cemetery Walk this weekend. Tickets at the museum, Evergreen Memorial Cemetery, and online at mchistory.org. Sponsored by the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
A new law is trying to change the outsized impact the court system has on poor people.
The fees that a defendant pays in a case are supposed to supplement their addition to the court system. It's not supposed to finance it.
Former State Representative Steve Anderson tells Mary Cullen why he wrote a bill changing the court fee structure in Illinois. Plus, an interview with Normal Mayor Chris Koos and hear how an 8-year-old girl from Normal fell through the cracks at DCFS. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Critics have said the legal system hurts low and moderate income people more than rich ones. Fines and fees can pile one upon the other and hurt the ability of poor people to access transportation, employment, and even basic shelter. That was supposed to change this year. Before leaving office, former Governor Bruce Rauner signed the Criminal and Traffic Assessment Act into law. The bipartisan reform measure took effect in July. In part one of a three-part series on fines and fees, WGLT's Mary Cullen explores the goals of the law and what changes McLean County judges see in their courtrooms.
The new law is supposed to change Illinois court fines and fees across all jurisdictions. Former State Representative Steve Anderson sponsored the measure. The Geneva Republican says he had four goals at the top of his list. The first is to lower fines and fees overall.
There's a balance there that was originally intended to be struck where the fees that a defendant pays in a case are supposed to supplement their addition to the court system. It's not supposed to finance it. What has happened is that has flip-flopped.
Anderson says financing the court system is now on the back of the defendants who participate in the process. Anderson says he thinks taxes should fund the court system because it's a function of state government. He says the state does not pay for the legal system in all 102 counties, which is how court costs got to be so high. Anderson says scores of external agencies benefited from court fines and fees, well beyond what is appropriate.
The fees needed to relate to the charge that they've been accused of or that they're involved in.
For example, under the previous law, traffic offenders who paid fines and fees to McLean County would pay more than $16 to the Children's Advocacy Center. And that's whether the crime they committed involved children or not. Anderson calls it a tax on the biggest volume court system. Traffic court. He says under the new Criminal and Traffic Assessment Act, fines and fees must relate to the crime. The law breaks down all costs imposed on people into local and state justice systems. There are more than a dozen categories of fees or schedules in addition to fines. Here's the local breakdown. The circuit clerk gets $25 of each. Around $50 goes to the court, and the county general fund gets a cut too, between $47 and $300. The state share of fees depends on the crime. A felony drug convict has to send $1,500 to the drug treatment fund. Sexual offenders put $200 towards sexual assault services for each conviction. McLean County Judge Scott Drzeski says most fees went down when the system switched to these schedules. But Drzeski says in general, traffic offenses went up.
It would appear that the goal of the legislation was to collect more money by imposing fines and assessments upon individuals that have the ability to pay those fines and assessments imposed.
The new law expands a state waiver program for court costs. An offender can now get relief if they earn up to 400% of the federal poverty level. That means someone who makes up to $50,000 a year is still eligible for a 25% waiver of court costs. Judge Drzeski says the court can't look at debt or assets to determine fees. More residents are qualifying for waivers than ever before. But there's a catch, and it's a big one. Traffic offense fines and fees are not eligible for any waivers, regardless of income. And traffic fees went up under the law. McLean County Chief Judge Mark Fellheimer says it's not ideal, but that's the legislation.
Certainly, if someone comes in and wants an extension and is making a good faith effort to pay their fines and costs, certainly, at least from my perspective, I'll do whatever I can to extend that out for them.
Fellheimer says the law is mandatory and they have to follow it. McLean County Court Administrator Will Scanlon says the philosophical reason lawmakers raised fines and fees for traffic offenses is simple. He says driving is a right, not a privilege. A misdemeanor DUI carries a $1,300 fee. A felony DUI, $1,700. Scanlon compares those assessments to the $550 fee for a murder conviction. That doesn't include other fees related to the conditions of the crime, but Scanlon says the base fees are vastly different. He says the person who committed murder qualifies for a waiver, but will likely get time in jail. The person found guilty of a felony DUI is on the hook for those funds regardless of their income and won't get their driver's license back until they pay up. McLean County Judge Casey Costigan says the court is more likely to get the traffic money because the offender wants to resume driving. That is, unless they're low income and can't pay. Former State Representative Steven Anderson says he also wanted his bill to make court costs more transparent. Anderson says under the previous system, offenders had no idea what they had to pay until their first appearance in court. Under the new Criminal and Traffic Assessment Act, Anderson says it's easier to do the math at home before deciding how to plead. Anderson says the only unknown is the fine for the crime itself. Judges set fines. The new law has minimum fines, but leaves it up to the judge to choose a fine that, quote, fits the crime. McLean County Court Administrator Will Scanlon says the minimum fine for traffic offenses is $25. All others have a minimum of $75. Scanlon says under the previous law, minimum fines were $1.
A dollar fine could still result in $200+ or the cost. So people still had sticker shock, as it were, when they got it. They heard a dollar fine, and they still ended up paying $215.
Addressing that problem gave way to Anderson's fourth goal for the law, making court fines and fees uniform across the state. He says before, a traffic offender pulled over on one side of the street might have to pay hundreds of dollars in court. And if a cop pulled them over on the other side of the road in a different jurisdiction, the cost might be a lot lower. All of these are big changes. People coming into court still might not know their potential costs, even if they did know the drill under the old system. Judges in McLean County say public defenders have the job to educate defendants. Here's Chief Judge Mark Fellheimer.
It is going to take time, just like any other change in the law, to educate the public.
Fellheimer says implementation in McLean County is going well. Judge Casey Costigan agrees because McLean County was ready.
Have there been some things we've had to adjust? Yes, there have. But those adjustments have gone fairly smoothly. The law is rolled out, I think, as it was intended to be, and we're applying the law as the legislature intended it to be implied.
But the virtues of clarity, transparency, simplicity, all can be undone, and it doesn't take long. Remember, the new law took effect in July. The legislature and governor have already approved two new measures that add fines and fees. The Scott's Law violation and the Roadside Memorial Fund. The judges say they will continue to update courtroom procedures as lawmakers change them. I'm Mary Cullen.
Not everyone thinks the new law is such a big improvement. Listen in tomorrow for part two of the McLean County Fines and Fees series and hear about what problems the Criminal and Traffic Assessment Act does not address. The series was prepared as a reporting project for the John J. Arnold Fines and Fees Justice Reporting Fellowship. This is Sound Ideas. Thank you.
Hear the top NPR and local GLT news stories handpicked just for you right now on the NPR One app. Listen to GLT newscasts and our biggest stories on demand, or settle in for some podcast listening. You can even customize your favorite types of stories. NPR One has it all. Think Spotify or Pandora for news. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Like many cities and towns across Illinois, Normal is getting ready for marijuana legalization. It has some decisions to make about where it can be sold, how those sales would be taxed, what it means for law enforcement. The Normal Town Council discussed some of those issues last night. Here in studio to recap that discussion and the regular council meeting is Normal Mayor Chris Koos. Thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Let's have that chat.
Well, Mayor Koos, what were your most important takeaways from last night's discussion about cannabis?
I think the education of the mechanics of the ordinance, what we can do, what we cannot do as a municipality, what are some of the opaque issues within the bill, and apparently there are many, and you know, it kind of gave council a path forward to make decisions based on what the law says. We have yet to have the discussion on the policy, and is that something we're going to do or not do? But staff felt, and I agree, that it was important to have this baseline information.
We talk about a path forward. What are the next steps here? How is this thing going to kind of move around within the town, different commissions, boards, and then back up to the council?
Right. So we're starting a process, and people may say, oh, they're just going to go ahead and legalize it, and that's not true. It's just because of the timelines the state set and the hoops that we have to go through locally, if we're going to do that, we have to start that process almost immediately. And what that would be is a formal direction from the council to forward this issue to the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission would hold a public hearing. They would make their decision for a recommendation. And that would go back to the council. And so that's 3 or 4 months worth of work in terms of notifying the public when these events are going to happen. So even though we've started the process, doesn't mean we should assume that we are going to pass an ordinance. That's not the case. We just have to honor the timeline. What we will probably recommend, well, at staff recommendation, I think council agreed with it last night, was special use permits for a grow site or a dispensary or a what they call an infuser or a processor. Those are all options within our area. And we have decided that special use permitting is the best way to do that, which would limit the locations to B1, B2 business districts or manufacturing districts.
So if you go that route, the kind of the special use permit route, what are some ways that town will be able to kind of measure and evaluate community impact? You know, be it on parking, be it on what hours they can operate. What are sort of the menu of things that you think should be part of that consideration?
You know, those are all considerations we have in the special use permitting process, and you know, a lot of those questions are determined by location. What's the physical location look like? Is it a building where we think they might have 100 vehicles a day and there's only parking for two? Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So you're right. Those kind of issues are things we're going to have to look at as part of a special permitting use.
Well, as you talk about location, what about Uptown Normal? Did the council get into the idea of, are we going to allow something like this in, you know, the heart of our community, Uptown Normal?
It was talked about very briefly, but I think the general feeling was no, that it would not be allowed in Uptown Normal.
And why is that?
I think the council feels that it's not the right fit for the business district. And you know, there are limitations, how far it is from a church, how far it is from a school, how far it is from Children's Discovery Museum. Those are all issues that we have addressed with gambling and liquor, and we're applying those same standards to a potential marijuana site.
So what amount of interest has the town received up to this point from cannabis businesses, prospective business owners who are kicking the tires, trying to get a sense of what kind of opportunities may exist
actually,
in the
actually
town?
None.
Zero.
We have not had any, to my knowledge. And when medical marijuana came along, we had a lot of contacts for that. I think what is happening right now is that the people that want to get in that business of legalized cannabis for recreational purposes are working with the state. There's only a finite amount of permits. There's a point system you have to honor to be selected. There may be other things in the state of Illinois that, who knows?
Yeah, so if there's interest, it may not just be coming to the town. It's
right.
going in a different place.
So I think they're working with the state to queue up. To get licensing. Now, they're still doing it by state police districts. And so Bloomington, the District 5 here for Bloomington Normal would be mostly McLean County and DeWitt County. And currently, the only medical marijuana site is in North Normal, and they can convert to recreational.
This is the green solution up in
right.
North Normal.
Yeah. And we don't know if they can convert to recreational and still stay medical. That's not very clear in the language. And they could, by right, open another location within McLean County, Woodford County. And then by the formula the state's come up with, one new vendor could come in. So that would be the most you could have for three counties.
And has the town heard anything from Green Solution about whether it's signaling, yes, we want to open a second one somewhere?
No, we haven't heard from them, and I'm sure they're just kind of watching how this develops. You know, it may be a moot point if Normal decides we don't want it. We're not going to allow it in the town of Normal.
Do you sense that there's an appetite for the opt-out route within your council?
Only in the sense of being inquisitive and wanting to make their decision based on sound information and feedback from the electorate.
Are you an opt-out person yourself?
Generally, I am supportive of having it legalized in town of Normal because it's going to be legal, and as I often say, I'm in a community with 21,000 college students. Marijuana's already here.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Coos, let's pivot over to Rivian. The company is hosting a big community event this coming Sunday in Uptown Normal. Going to be showing off a few of its electric vehicles, which is the first time a lot of folks in our community will ever have seen them in person. So what is this thing going to look like on Sunday? What are we going to be seeing?
Well, I think it's an open house. For people to come and see and maybe touch the vehicle. I don't know if they're going to have bollards around it or not. But to see the two new vehicles, they want to showcase them in the community that they're going to be built. RJ Scaringe, the CEO, will be here. I don't know that he'll be here for the whole time. There will be a private VIP showing of that vehicle from 12 to 1 and then from 1 to 4 open to the general public. There will also be a place to apply for work at Rivian if you're so inclined. That's kind of a mini job fair directed towards Rivian at this event. And I'm sure they've got a lot of other tricks up their sleeve to make people happy they came.
Yeah, Rivian has a sense of theatricality. These events usually are tied to some sort of announcement of some kind. Are we going to see some sort of announcement of note?
My guess is you probably will see something, and I
do you want to just save us the time, Mayor Coos? You can just tell us what it is now if you want.
I can truthfully say I have no idea what that would be.
Well, in all seriousness, there are some really interesting jobs that Rivian has posted on its website right now for the plants, like battery manufacturing engineer, maintenance tech, quality assurance engineer, all these kind of jobs. Does Central Illinois' workforce like have enough people to fill jobs like that? Or are we going to see a lot of people coming in from not just like Peoria, Decatur, but actually like moving in from out of state even?
I think yes to all of that. I think the workforce here certainly can respond to some of the needs of Rivian. In fact, most of the early hires at Rivian that are in the factory right now are ex-Mitsubishi employees. That was very surprising to me, but a lot of them are still in the area, and the opportunity to get back into automotive manufacturing apparently appealed to them.
And I always wondered how many of them were still left. You know, a lot of them got retrained or maybe left the community for other work, but there are still enough left to,
there,
to get started.
There still, and I think some went to other manufacturing facilities in the area and came back to work for Rivian. There will be certain jobs that that obviously draw from outside the area because the skills aren't here, the expertise. It's important to note that Rivian and Heartland Community College are working very hard together on training programs for future Rivian employees. Programming robotics is probably high on the list. I was in Rochester Hills, Michigan this week for a mayor's conference and met the people for Fennec North America, which is the largest robotics manufacturer in North America, and they have a partnership with Heartland Community College to train people on in real time on state-of-the-art robotics.
That's Normal Mayor Chris Koos. Thanks for coming in today and for your time on Sound Ideas.
Great. Thank you.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after the regular and special council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. After a break, an 8-year-old girl from Normal falls through the cracks inside DCFS. This is Sound Ideas.
You hear her almost every day, bringing you the news of the day.
The Trump administration opens hearings today on the president's plan to slap import taxes on some.
Since 1990, she's delivered news during NPR's Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Weekend Edition. And now she'll deliver a behind-the-scenes peek into National Public Radio on October 18th at WGLT's annual Radio Faces.
I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News. From Washington.
Join us for Radio Faces on October 18th. Details, menu choices, and tickets at WGLT.org.
The news you need when you want it. That's what you'll find at our website, WGLT.org. The latest local news stories, plus reports from Springfield, Washington, and around the world. You can also subscribe to our podcast and catch up on your favorite GLT features, from GLT's Grow to John Norton's music interviews and everything in between. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. When a doctor began the autopsy of an 8-year-old Bloomington Normal girl in January, he started by counting the scars on her body. There were 67 marks signaling extensive abuse, but it was the internal injuries to the abdomen that killed the girl. Her name is Rika Roundtree. The girlfriend of Rika's father goes on trial next week for murder. Cynthia Baker allegedly kicked Rika in the stomach, causing those internal injuries that slowly killed her.
Everybody failed her. I failed her.
That's Rika's mother, Ann Simmons. While Baker is the one facing trial, Simmons says there were many others who were aware of the abuse and failed to stop it.
The dragging her through the house, the smashing her face into the wall, the torture that she went through is all the stuff that I tried to tell them that she was going through and nobody would listen to me.
Rika was one of over 100 children who've died in the past year while involved in some way with the Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS. The deaths have prompted an overhaul of the state agency that cares for children. In Rika's case, the key question is why authorities in 2016 sent Rika to live with her father in Baker, a woman who WGLT has learned was twice before placed on a list of known child abusers. Simmons largely blames DCFS. We spoke to her in prison in Decatur, where she's finishing a 2.5-year prison sentence in a forgery case and for failing to complete the terms of her probation on an aggravated DUI.
Your only position in this world is to protect our children when the parents can't. That's your position, is to pick up where we fall short and try to keep us together. I'm not sure where they dropped the ball at with giving a care about our kids, but they did.
DCFS faces scrutiny for how rarely it removes children from their home. Illinois actually has the lowest foster care entry rate in the U.S. And a study commissioned earlier this year after a string of child deaths, including Rika's, found that DCFS staff don't feel empowered to recommend removal, even when they feel it's warranted. Before all this, before she was a number or a poster child for DCFS reforms, Simmons says that Rika was an independent kid with a big imagination, especially with her dolls.
So I became a grandma of all the little doll babies, and she would go to like yard sales and we'd pick up like strollers and car seats and clothes and Pampers at the store. She needed baby bottles, all that stuff.
Rika was exactly the kind of kid who needed protection.
Her family has a history of domestic violence and substance abuse. Rika's parents, Simmons and Richard Roundtree, split up in 2015 and later divorced. That family fractured even further in 2016 when Rika was still living with her mother. Police raided her mother's home and arrested Simmons on drug charges. Rika went to live with her father and his girlfriend, Cynthia Baker. By the middle of 2017, court and police records show Rika was raising concerns about Baker. Simmons says that her daughter was visibly fearful around Baker. DCFS investigated Baker for allegedly hitting Rika with a belt, but found no credible evidence of abuse. Simmons says this is when Rika's behavior started to change.
She was just different. She was more reserved. She was really cautious about a lot of stuff, whereas before she was carefree. She ran the house. She was a princess. She did what she wanted to do.
In April 2018, during a visit at Rika's school, Simmons says she was shocked to see her daughter with a split lip, black eye, broken tooth, scars on her neck, and her hair cut really short. When DCFS investigated, Rika explained away her injuries as clumsy accidents at home. DCFS says Rika denied anyone was hurting her in the home or that she was fearful of anyone. DCFS labeled any claims of abuse as unfounded. 4 months later, in October of 2018, Simmons says her ex-husband had made it clear he was done with Rika.
He was telling me that I need to find a knight in shining armor to save Rika because he didn't want nothing to do with her. He didn't want to pay child support. He didn't want visits. He didn't want to be her father. He just wanted her to be adopted out so that he didn't have any obligation to her.
Around this time, the animosity at home between Baker and Rika worsened. Authorities say the staff at Rika's school provided her with a coat, a gesture that authorities said sparked an irate response from Baker. She allegedly accused the school staff of favoring Rika over Baker's own daughter. After the coat incident, prosecutors say Rika arrived at school in December 2018 with two black eyes. School staff notified DCFS. Prosecutors say Baker became angry with school officials for doing that. She claimed Rika was just clumsy and had given herself the black eyes. Rika said she hurt herself by falling on some toys. And so, for the third time in 16 months, a DCFS investigation of Richard and Baker determined any claims of abuse to be unfounded. Baker pulled her daughter and Rika from the school and enrolled them at Prairieland Elementary instead. Simmons was continuing her custody fight for Rika. But a month later, in January of 2019, a judge determined Simmons was not making enough progress on the terms of her probation. He sentenced her to 2.5 years in prison for not completing probation and for a separate forgery case. He said her efforts to get back on track were too little, too late. By then, it was also too late for Rika. On January 26, 2019, Rika became unresponsive after several days of belly pain. An ambulance took Rika to Advocate Broman Hospital. She had a large bruise on her abdomen and was transferred to Peoria. She went into surgery for internal injuries but died on the operating table. A forensic pathologist determined Rika died from peritonitis caused by blunt force injury. Simmons was just over 2 weeks into her prison sentence.
I got called to the chaplain's office. And they called my 18-year-old son, and my 18-year-old son had to do the worst thing he ever had to do in his life. And he had to tell me that my baby girl was gone. She wasn't coming back.
During a 3-month investigation of Richard Roundtree and Cynthia Baker, investigators discovered cell phone videos allegedly documenting Baker's ongoing abuse of Rika. Prosecutors charged Baker with murder and aggravated domestic battery. The state removed 4 other children living in their home, including 2 teenagers who prosecutors said witnessed and experienced significant abuse themselves. DCFS says that Baker and Richard were both indicted for multiple allegations of abuse and neglect related to Rika's death, meaning DCFS believes they were responsible for the injury. It wasn't the first time that Baker was indicated for abuse. According to court records obtained by WGLT, Baker was found to have caused injuries to his stepchild in 2002 and her own daughter in 2012. Baker's murder trial is set to begin Tuesday. One of her attorneys, Brendan Bukowski, said in a statement she's innocent and they look forward to a jury hearing her case. It's unclear if Rika's father, Richard Roundtree, could also face criminal charges in her death. He hasn't so far. Here's Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner.
That is part of that whole investigation. We certainly work with DCFS, but we're also working with the state's attorney's office on that. And again, we're cautious as we move through this to make sure that we have, if we do have a case, that we can certainly bring that to a successful prosecution.
As Rika's death plays out in the criminal justice system, lawmakers hold it up as an example of why DCFS needs a major overhaul. Lawmakers point to the 100 or so children who die every year while under DCFS care of some kind. The agency's acting inspector general says that figure hasn't changed since 2013, showing Illinois is failing to improve. She notes DCFS's failure to complete thorough and timely investigations, a lack of clinical supervision of staff who are making life-altering decisions for families, and poor follow-through of past inspector general recommendations for how to fix known problems. In a recent memo to lawmakers, the inspector general wrote, "Management must support its investigators by giving them needed resources. Investigative shortcuts occur when investigators are overburdened." Rika's mother, Ann Simmons, questions why DCFS seemingly believed Rika's own explanations for her injuries. Simmons says DCFS could have done more to make Rika feel safe and be honest.
I said, if y'all go and check on her, pull her out of that place, take her somewhere safe and talk to her, she'll be honest with y'all. I said, at this point, I told them exactly what was going on. I said, they're putting the fear of God in my child. She gonna say whatever they tell her to say because y'all keep leaving her there.
After the July 2017 allegations involving the belt, Simmons says two DCFS investigators had only a brief 5-minute conversation with Rika at a bus stop outside the McLean County Courthouse.
And that was it. And it was over with. It was done.
This issue came up during a May 2019 hearing in Springfield when the House Adoption and Child Welfare Committee asked DCFS leadership about a string of recent child deaths, including Rika's. Here's State Representative Ann Moeller, a Democrat from Elgin, asking a staffer about Rika's case.
I look at Rika Roundtree, who went to school several times with obvious signs of abuse and black eyes, broken, missing teeth, and was, told teachers, told the investigators that, she had run into appliances at home or, fell on her toys or whatnot. That's not being used to determine whether or not there's abuse, correct? I would hope. You tell me.
So when we have children and we talk to children, one of the things that we do, we listen to them, we listen to what they want to tell us, we ask them questions to try and specify, dates and time as best we can, because we're talking to a child, so it's a little bit different than talking with an adult. One of the other things that we do is that we ask that person, that child, is there somebody you feel safe with or somebody that makes you feel safe, so that we can use that person as a collateral and that we can go talk to that person. We also hope to utilize our medical providers so that when there's situations that we can go in and we can say, here's what we have. Does this appear plausible? Is this possible that it could have happened this way? So there's a lot that goes into a finding. Yes, we do listen to what the child says, but that's only a portion of what we listen to when we're making our decisions.
With Rika's recurring injuries, why wasn't she removed from the home and placed in foster care? One reason is that Illinois has largely moved away from family separations as a practice. Doris Houston is director of ISU's Center for Child Welfare and Adoption Studies. She's a former DCFS child welfare administrator. She says decades ago, as many as 50,000 children were in foster care. Now it's down to around 17,000.
Is a good thing, but if we are going that route, we have to make sure there are the services available, readily available for families. Our society is facing some really complex problems.
A study this year from Chapin Hall at the University of Chicago found that some DCFS workers face pressure to keep families together, even after evidence of abuse or neglect. Houston says the foster system cannot handle many of the cases.
The flip side, though, is we don't always have enough foster parents and foster homes to adequately serve the needs of children. And every foster home isn't equipped for every foster child.
DCFS is still investigating Rika's death. The agency says it's committed to understanding exactly what happened in the case and being fully transparent with the public. DCFS says it's working closely with the new Pritzker administration to review its practices, policies, and procedures to fully live up to its mission to protect vulnerable children in Illinois. This year's state budget includes a $130 million budget increase for DCFS, and the agency plans to hire hundreds of new employees. Here's Doris Houston again from ISU.
I really look at the increases that have occurred this year as absolutely as essential to really get the agency back on its footing in terms of hiring, in terms of resources, even things we don't think of like data management. All of those kinds of things really take resources.
Ann Simmons, Rika's mother, is scheduled to be released from Decatur Correctional Center in December. First thing on her to-do list is finding Rika's remains. She was cremated, but Simmons says no memorial service was held. Simmons also has four sons. She says she wants to try and regain custody of her 12-year-old. She says she wants to share her story.
My daughter should have not have ever died. It should have never been this way. Something has to happen from the beginning, so that the ends don't be like this.
Simmons says she hopes to become an advocate for fixing a system she feels let her daughter down, so medical examiners don't have to count the abuse scars on the bodies of other little girls and boys. Cynthia Baker's trial begins Tuesday at the McLean County Law and Justice Center. I'm Ryan Denham reporting with WGLT correspondent Edith Brady Lunny. This is Sound Ideas.
I've been hopping freight trains all my life.
Vince Gill is one of the most accomplished musicians in country history. He's also one of the nicest guys ever. And we're going to talk to him about his latest album, the very personal and autobiographical Okie. Plus, we've got some incredible stripped-down performances. It's Vince Gill on the next World Cafe.
You can hear World Cafe 7 to 9 tonight on WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Sometimes little mistakes have big consequences, and for no apparent reason, leaving us to decide the why for ourselves. WGLT correspondent Brianna Grobe brings you Pete Geither's Oops story from the September Next to Normal Story Slam.
18 months ago, Pete Geither fell off his bike. You've probably done the same thing plenty of times, but Geither's fall was anything but typical. It all started with a bike ride along the Constitution Trail one chilly March morning. After taking a left past Rosa Parks Park,
and I realized that my right glove wasn't all the way on, and I reached over to pull it on a little better, and the handlebars wobbled a little bit, and I reached over with the left hand to grab it, and the bike got unbalanced and sort of just toppled over to the left, and I fell awkwardly, and my glasses went flying. Well, that was silly. Embarrassing too, with all these people around, you know. So I went, okay, well, everybody's seen this. Hey, you okay, mister? Yes, I'm fine. At least I'm not hurt, you know. And I was just a silly fall. Thank you. He said, well, we'll be down here if you need anything. Thanks again. I figured, at least, you know, I didn't get a bruise or a scrape, which is the worst that you could get from such a fall. So I went to get up and didn't. My left leg wouldn't move. Odd. You sure you're okay, mister? Yeah, I just need to catch my breath. I'll be heading home. Thanks. Went to get up again and didn't. My left leg wasn't accepting commands. It was as if all the electrical impulses had just stopped there and nothing was happening. I didn't understand. At this point, the slightest wispy edges of the words broken leg drifted through my consciousness and were immediately rejected. They surfaced again, and I replaced them with hairline fracture, which was still ridiculous, but at least I could think about that, you know? So, and I thought, well, if I have a hairline fracture, what do I do? Well, I should have somebody take a look at it. I'll get on my bike and ride to the doctor. No, that doesn't compute. I'll have somebody take me to the doctor. Who? I could call 911, and my brain exploded. Call 911 for this nothing?
But Geither did call 911, and as it turned out, it wasn't nothing.
The orthopedic surgeon later described to me what had happened in words that sounded like absolute gibberish to me, involving a tibia and fibula and tibial flat toe and comminuted fracture and knee. What I gathered was that apparently I had fallen just perfectly on the side of my leg, so that one bone had broken and driven into the other bone, shattering it, sending fragments into my knee and all around my leg, and so that nothing was really connected anymore down there.
Arriving at the hospital, Geither began to realize the severity of his condition.
Emergency was a cacophony of sounds as I blocked out all visual stimuli by closing my eyes to the pain. There was a makeshift IV in the back of my hand in the ambulance because they couldn't get to my arms because of the jackets. As they cut off my jeans, I remember smiling slightly as I thought about the hole in my back pocket that had bothered me this morning and would no longer. Promises of morphine. And they set up incomplete pictures of my leg with a jury-rigged x-ray machine on top of my stretcher. All I'm getting is air, not blood. The back of the hand IV was fine for the ambulance, but no good for the ER. So they wrestled off the jackets and put needles in my arms, taking blood samples, promises of morphine, more promises of morphine, and the realization that morphine had been coming all along in the IV and had been having no effect.
The hospital's orthopedic surgeon happened to be in the building that day. After reviewing Geithner's x-rays, the surgeon paid him a visit.
Figuring that I might be a little fuzzy and making sure that I wouldn't have words like hairline fracture dancing in my head, he says to me, "You messed up your leg really bad. Really, really bad. It's going to be at least 6 to 8 months of recuperation. You're going to have the knee replaced at some point. Your leg may never be exactly the same again. Tomorrow, I'm going to do a long operation on your leg, probably around 3 p.m.
Hospital staff fitted Geithner's leg with a splint to hold the shattered limb together and wheeled him to his room to wait.
Having surgery 24 hours away when you're in pain is an excruciating experience as you stare at that whiteboard with its false promise of hope, as you count down to when you can have the next morphine shot, which will, of course, have no effect. Finally, I'm wheeled down these corridors, down elevators, through the hospital. At every point that I was passed off, they asked me to verify what I was having done to me, which is what they do in the hospital, and they seemed to accept the answer that I was going to have someone rearrange my bone fragments into something more coherent in my left leg. So I get down to the basement, dark, dingy, uncertain lighting, and I'm there, and they're trying to move me onto the operating table. After several attempts and tiring of my screams, they just decide to put me out.
When Geithner came to, reality was nowhere to be found.
The setting: an indistinct room somewhere between the size of an office and a stadium. Walls, partitions, gray, film noir. Next to me is a woman playing the role of a random person selected to sit with an unaccompanied patient after post-op recovery. Poised, soft-spoken, undemanding. I arrive in this scene mid-consciousness, find myself already explaining to her that none of this matters. It isn't real. That she isn't real. This room doesn't exist. And despite that fact, I thank her because I've been enjoying the conversation with her. But I know that she's not real, that this is all a fluke in the time continuum that happened back at the park. And once it's corrected, this part's all going to erase. Either that, or it's going to be the inception kick of the song that's going to take me out of that dream world and put me back into the real world.
Then a hospital staffer came by to see how Geithner was doing.
Do you know what just happened? Do you know where you're going next? Suddenly paranoid that this is some sort of an attempt to prove my sanity, that I pull myself together and I say, I was just in surgery where a nice man presumably successfully reassembled the bones into something resembling a leg. Now I'm recovering from anesthesia, and they're going to wheel me to room 223. He said, "You'll be fine."
But Geithner didn't feel fine. He learned that during the three-hour operation, the surgeon had placed 3 titanium plates and 22 screws in his leg.
And, you know, I would look at my leg, and it didn't seem like it was part of me. It was foreign. I didn't want it. It was like some sort of an alien tumor next to my right leg. I asked them if they could just unscrew it and put in a nutrient bath until it was healed and then put it back on when it was all better, because I didn't want to look at it, but they said no.
Geithner injected plenty of humor into his episodic account of recovery, even detailing bizarre hallucinations as he watched common objects change and morph back into themselves. But he says it was a journey to rewrite his story from one of tragedy.
I mean, there's no doubt with this kind of a situation, when you're going through all this, that you have those days where you just can't cope, you know, and it just, it sort of breaks you down. And that's kind of why I wrote this story, was I needed that kind of release, that something to take me out of it, to keep me from despairing about where I was, but instead, as I said at the end, me turning into something heroically absurd, you know, and have that be the story and not it be about, oh, poor me, I can't do anything, why did this happen to me, and all that. And believe me, I had some days like that.
Right, especially with something that seemed kind of meaningless, like it could have happened to anybody, and there wasn't really a reason behind it. But you're talking about this framing your own story. Is this something that you shared with other people who have maybe gone through accidents or even have like a disability that they're trying to cope with?
Well, I actually started writing this story when I was in the hospital. And so I would take little bits and pieces of it and add to it and add to it. And I did share it with people in the hospital while I was there. And I've shared it with people since. And eventually I hope to maybe include it in a book of stories. We'll see. But yeah, it was important to me. And I've tried to help that with other people too. And you're exactly right, because yeah, it's not like I was in a car accident or some major thing that happened, you know. I fell off my bicycle. The silliest, stupid thing, something that I had ridden my bike 1,000 miles the year before. I know how to ride a bike, you know. It's not like I'm an idiot, except at that moment, of course. But those things happen to everybody. You know, you do that silly thing, and then suddenly it's there. And you have to realize that that's just part of what life is, you know? You do those silly things and you can't beat yourself up about it. You have to just go, okay, this is absurd, and let's enjoy the absurdity of it and still find ways to carry on.
I know that, especially for the purposes of this story, we don't want to dwell on, you know, how much it sucked or, but you know, you did mention that it changed your life in significant ways. Can you talk to me about that?
Well, yeah, I think certainly, I mean, I was, you know, just getting into retirement, thinking about all the traveling I was going to do and everything else. And suddenly, you know, I'm dealing with all this and operations, and I still have one more operation to come. And so going through all of this really kind of short-circuited what was supposed to be, you know, me doing all this great stuff. Now, once I realized I couldn't let that stop me, I just found different ways of doing things. So even though I was dealing with all this, this spring I went to New York twice, I went to Morocco, I went to Jamaica, and I will say that the crutches helped me get through security a lot faster.
Nice. And I also think sometimes it feels uncomfortable if maybe people say, well, look on the bright side. But you seem to be the kind of guy who does that. Have there been things that it has made you either realize or appreciate?
Well, I think I've always been a little bit of the glass half full, the optimistic. You know, that's been sort of my way of dealing with things, and I prefer that. I like looking at things on the bright side. And like I said, I do have those dark moments, but it works better if you can take that bright side and enjoy it and not get bogged down on it. It's also better for recovery if you can find the positive things. And, you know, there are so many people who have so much worse things that they're dealing with in their lives than a leg. You know, it's a leg. And it's a pain, and it's annoying, and I hate dealing with it, but it's a leg. I had my helmet on, my head's fine. So, you know, that's the way I had to think about it, was look at, I can still do the things that I like to do, I just have to do it a little differently.
Geithner's story isn't over yet. He has one more surgery ahead, which he hopes will decrease his pain and increase his mobility. Then it'll be back to enjoying retirement, mostly as planned. I'm Brianna Groh.
You can hear more stories on WGLT's Next and Rummel Story Slam podcast. Get it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And the Next to Paranormal Story Slam, I should say, is back with spooky tales of the supernatural. That'll be Friday, October 25th at 7:30 p.m. at the McLean County Arts Center in Bloomington. If you like WGLT's podcasts, like the Story Slam, here's another one to check out. It's called The Leadoff. You can fit a whole day's worth of WGLT into your morning routine with this daily morning podcast. You can listen to The Leadoff while you're on the morning jog or making a big pot of coffee or biking to work. It's a daily digest of news and calendar items. It's only 8 minutes long, so you'll finish in plenty of time to get on with your day informed and engaged. Subscribe to WGLT's The Leadoff now on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more at wglt.org/leadoff. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas today on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen and Brianna Groh. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. And we want to know what you think of Sound Ideas, so comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLTFM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Ryan WGLT. One more bit of good news. We've just added Marketplace to the WGLT schedule. You can hear it every weekday at 5 p.m. during All Things Considered. This award-winning show is Public Radio's daily magazine on business and economic news. Monday through Friday, you'll discover what the day in money delivered as Marketplace delivers the news to you. So join us for Marketplace later today at 5 p.m., made possible by CEFQ Business Services. Get more info at wglt.org/marketplace. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington-Normal's public media.